So I think we're worth starting with racism as an issue, because in South Africa, I was, you know, where I lived till I was 21, everyone was racist. It was just the way it was. Everyone was racist. I was lucky enough to know that I was racist quite early on in life, but a lot of people didn't. When I went back to South Africa about 15 years ago, one of my aunts actually apologized to me because she had given my family a really hard time when I was involved in politics. And because she said she didn't know what was going on. She said she never knew. And she was a really bright woman who was a lawyer, studied as a lawyer, and her husband was a lawyer. My uncle was a lawyer too. She said they didn't know. And it's phenomenal that something can be so deep that you're not even aware of it, you know?
How did you not see it?
And she was part of the church. She was part of the Catholic Church too, you know? So I want to talk about the Catholic Church stuff because I think that's really important. But the racism stuff is fascinating. And there was a couple of turning points for me. And one was the youngest memory I have had of feeling really uncomfortable was going up to my grandfather's farm and in the back of his big car, and there were lots of us. I'm one of eight kids, and so we couldn't have all been in there. But anyway, a lot of us were in the days when you didn't wear seatbelts. And he stopped it. They were going through the gates to the farm, and there were lots of little kids, black kids, standing there, kind of excited about this big car coming in. And he threw lollies to all the kids, and it just struck me. I suddenly put myself in their position, I think, and thought, this is just, it was so condescending, I think. Mm-hmm. That was the problem. It was just, even I could see it, and I would have been six or seven or something, I could see it as really condescending. It was just appalling. The other thing that really struck me too was one day we were staying at my great aunt's beach shack up the coast, and I was changing, going at a beach shack, which only had one changing room, and the rest of it was basically a big room where you slept and ate and cooked and did everything else. And in the changing room where you kept your clothes and you got a bit of privacy, I and another boy my age, we were probably, I don't know, 7, 8 again, were too embarrassed to get changed in front of the servant, whose name was Slan, and he kind of, you know, he was in the room cleaning up or something. He was a middle-aged man, and he said, "What are you two doing?" In broken English, he said, "What are you two boys? Why aren't you getting dressed?" And we couldn't explain why we were too embarrassed. And he said, "Well, look," and he just pulled down his pants and he said, "Look at me, I'm just the same." Astonishing. And that really made me realize in a major way, you know, and also to understand that he was prepared to embarrass himself because he thought it was so important that we understood or something, you know. Anyway, it was deeply kind of memorable. And then when I was at school, we had a Chinese boy in our class. It wasn't all boys. Private Catholic school, Chinese boy in our class, Chinese family, part of the school community, and then the government decided that they needed to tighten up and how they officially described your race, because the whole country was based on the fact that people were different races, and different races you could only do certain things. And so that they decided to do a colour test on all these people who were kind of in between rate when it wasn't clear whether they were neither black nor white. So people with coffee-coloured skin, darker skin. So what they did, and at the time, it was the Chinese people came into the category of non-white, where Japanese were considered white for the purposes of business and trade. You know, it's just boggling. They used to, well, the way I understood it, they got a swatch of different colours, like skin colour tones, and you'd have to go into the police station if you were one of people, there was Chinese and coloured people and, you know, anyone with mixed race, mixed heritage, suspiciously dark-looking skin. You'd have to go to a police station and they'd get a swatch of colours in that colour range and hold it next to your skin, and then you'd be classified either white or non-white according to the
And that
the
determined
swatch.
Your future.
It determined everything about the future for you and your children, you know. What school you went to, what school they could go to, what kind of education they could get, what jobs you could get, where you could live. It was basically writing off, because at that time too they had the separate development policy, so that white people could only live in the cities or in white areas, which was where all the major cities were, and black people had to go back and live in their what they call the homelands, which were the traditional lands of those nations, black nations, where lots of them hadn't been for donkey's years anyway, or generations, and where there was incredible poverty. It was very poor farming country, basically. And so you'd end up having to go and live in places that you... And cities always had non-white areas, too, for mixed-race people. That Chinese boy had to leave school, go to a different school.
Go to a different school.
Yeah,
but
as a result,
Japanese boy could have stayed there.
Could have stayed there, yeah.
It's absurd.
It just made no sense at all.
And the involvement of the Catholic, of all of the churches, was quite remarkable.
So the churches, particularly from 1950s on, were very involved, and particularly the Catholic Church at that time, and I was brought up in the Catholic Church, so I was really aware of what was going on. Because religion has always been critical to white settlement in South Africa. And the Afrikaners, which basically were the refugees from Europe, from countries like Holland and Belgium, where they were the Protestants who were chased out of there by the Catholics, you know, ended up in South Africa. And they saw themselves, they had this kind of thing about seeing themselves as the chosen people, and so that when they escaped in South Africa from the British rule in the Cape, and they took the great trek up north to the northern part of the country, they saw it as going in search of the promised land, and they were the chosen people who were going in search of the promised land. So the whole country is based on this very religious kind of outlook. And the historical relationship between the Dutch Reformed Church and the Catholic Church is then very interesting, because they were victims of the Catholic kind of campaigns, anti-Presbyterian, anti-Protestant campaigns in Europe earlier, and had left their homelands to go to the south looking for the new land, the promised land, very much in the Old Testament. So that people like Beyers Naudé, who was a very well-known Dutch Reform minister, was a very strong opponent of apartheid as well. But that was unusual, because most of the Dutch Reform churches had different church services for whites and blacks, you know, whereas Catholic churches and other churches, Anglicans and in those days, you know, Methodists, at least you could both go to the same church service, and they'd have them in different languages, rather. So you'd have a Mass in Zulu or a Mass in English, whatever, you know, or Afrikaans. But it was different languages rather than different races.
Mm. And how was the Catholic Church viewed by the proponents of apartheid?
Well, the Catholic Church was seen in the... from, I think, the late 50s, and it was... As the Roman danger, you know, in Australia we have the yellow peril, this was the Roman danger, because the Catholic Church was seen as answering to an authority that was higher than different from the government of the country, really, is what they're talking about. And we're trying to, setting out to convert the whole country, all the black people in the country, to Catholicism as well. Because the Catholics did run lots of hospitals and schools and education, and they did a lot of those things right from the early days. The missions were huge. Anyone who was, everyone would be dead now, but people like our parents' age, you know, who were brought up you know, you do it, you'd eat your dinner because think of the black, the poor, starving black kids in Africa.
I was told that.
Yeah. It was just the way it was. Mm. Yeah.
Just, I'm a bit of out of left field, but I'm interested in your opinion. What did you think of the Truth and Reconciliation Commission in terms of the way that people would, if they admitted and acknowledged guilt, they could be exonerated?
At the time, I thought it was fantastic. It was just such a Christian way of approaching it, you know, in terms of a humanitarian and acknowledging that people behave in certain ways given the context that they're in at the time, and that's got to be some, you've got to give some credence to that, and I still think that. But it became really clear that the Truth and Reconciliation Commission allowed a softer approach that precluded harder negotiating about really important things like who had the money and the wealth in the country, who owned the land. It was brought down to such a human level that it kind of disallowed or didn't leave space for those really important conversations to have. And so that, you know, nowadays Nelson Mandela in South Africa is not seen as such a hero because he didn't negotiate hard enough on the basic things about equality, which is, you know, basic economic equality and opportunity.
But also, how can a person be forgiven for committing what can only be called abominations?
Yeah. I mean, I think what the Truth and Reconciliation Commission was trying to do was also to bring the country together.
Yes.
You know, it was, and do that. Yeah. It did do that at the time, yeah. To do that, you had to see or attempt to understand where both sides were coming from before, you know. I think it's just basic human relations. You've got to give credibility to someone else's motivations and stuff, even though their behaviour might present as appalling, you know.
But did it change racism in any way?
Change racism considerably, I think, considerably. Okay. I think the country changed really fast. And whether that was the Truth and Reconciliation Commission or whether it was just time or and Mandela's release and that, you know. But I think the Truth and Reconciliation Commission had a lot to do with it. And so that's, you know, what people like one of my aunts who apologised for being such a racist to me before, but she said, we didn't know. And I suspect the Truth and Reconciliation Commission allowed a lot of that to go. It was very powerful. It was a huge, powerful thing, you know. I remember when it was going on. It was just very powerful and very emotional because a lot of people were talking about their personal suffering and their personal involvement or their personal role in causing suffering to other people, you know, as a result of race. You know, I just think, and I don't know, I wasn't in the country at the time, so it's hard to tell. But I read a few books about it and document. And if I had been there, I don't know, because, you know, the security police went, lots of the security police officers appeared before the Truth and Reconciliation Commission, for example. Now, they were the kind of like the secret police of the country, you know. And I'd had run-ins with the security police when I was there as a young man, and I can't imagine forgiving them for some of the stuff they did. So I don't, you know, I'm not sure. It was a mighty thing. It was a mighty thing they did with that Truth and Reconciliation Commission. And they got fabulous people on it, you know, chairing it. You know, Tutu was amazing to have him there for lots of the time.
Does it have any parallels for the truth-telling that we hope is going to happen here?
I think it does. One of the things it did was allowed people's stories to be told in a way that people had to listen to them.
All people's.
All people's, both sides, all sides, their stories were told. And that has to be good, that people know the stories, you know. Because basically, I don't think, again, I'm not based on any research, but I don't think you can move on until you forgive. And until you can't forgive unless something's acknowledged and the story's told. I don't think it's possible to forgive. And I just think it's the same here. You know, I think it's absolutely crucial. Stories have to be told and things have to be acknowledged. They don't have to be it's not even apologized for, as just acknowledge that this happened. This is the fact of the situation, you know.
Makes you goosebumpy, doesn't it?
It's huge. It's huge stuff. And people just can't move forward without it. And South Africa couldn't move without that, I don't think. And, you know, I had friends who were killed, you know, by the police. And looking back, I find that remarkable, that that's a fact. But it is a fact, you know. Late 60s, early 70s, which is when I was at university, it's just the truth. And it's extraordinary that it's the truth, you know.
And do you think that you carry that trauma with you, the extraordinary bit of it?
I still get choked up.
And
as a young man, when I first arrived here, I had post-traumatic stress syndrome. You know, it was really awful at times. And I couldn't understand what I was doing here, but I was in Australia because... And Adelaide, the most white bread place in the country, apart from Don Dunstan, really.
Yep.
I was here because my family had all moved here.
Yeah.
Yeah, I didn't come on my own. I wouldn't have stayed if I'd come on my own. It was, and no one around either, no energy. It was, Africa's a place of extraordinary energy. It thrums, you know, there's an energy to the whole, everything, all the time, which Australia, and partly, I wonder, this is going right off thing, but I just wonder if it's not a geographic thing too, because Africa is a very new continent.
Yes.
Like it's formed, you know, it's still got active volcanoes and all that. Australia is an ancient continent. It's like the land here is just strung pure, you know, and the life just has to kind of shimmer. In there it thrums still.
Okay. That's really interesting too. That's really interesting. South Australia is ancient.
My mother was a geologist or studied geology, and she loved the landscape here. She just thought it was fabulous. She just raved about the age of the rocks and what had happened here.
And up in the Flinders Ranges too. That's some of the most ancient land.
Absolutely boggling.
Interesting, the life force that that you spoke about, that, you know, between Africa and Australia, isn't it?
Australia's like a really dry Riesling, you know, really crisp Riesling.
Yeah, it's done all its work.
And South Africa's like a really fruity Shiraz, it's completely.
I love
it's
that.
Completely different.
Yeah, you know? There's a paleontologist at Flinders University who talks with the Untamunk people and was totally amazed that they had a word in the vocabulary for dinosaurs. And yet dinosaurs were supposed to be long before humans. But they had a word and a description and a picture of what they were like.
Fantastic.
That's so ancient. So much that's interesting, isn't it?
It's fascinating too because, you know, Africa's where... Man originally, well, humankind originally kind of came from. And I can't work it out.
No.
I can't make sense of it. You know?
I heard one Aboriginal man that say, though, that he didn't come out of Africa, because if he did, he would have remembered.
Yeah, nice.
And that's what story's about, isn't it? This making sure that everything's remembered.
Mm, mm, mm.